afternoon. It's now time for KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. I'm your host, Mike Mason. Coming up on today's show, we get a report from last week's annual meeting of the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, and we'll hear about a new tool to allow some older drift vessels to be retrofitted. We'll also hear about a new project intended to train people for jobs in the fishing and seafood processing industries. All of that and more is coming up on today's edition of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. The Port Moeller test fishery got started on Monday, and today is the fifth day of fishing. The test fishery is run by BBEDC's Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute with assistance from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Scott Rayburn is a data analyst with BBSRI. He says it's a little too early to get a clear picture of what the data from the test fishery actually means for the sockeye resource headed to Bristol Bay.
Yeah, I would like to have some more time and more data points. Generally, Port Moeller has its greatest information content between the 25th of June and from there on out. It's most useful probably between the 25th and the 30th of June. But this early in the season, it's just too soon to tell or guess at what the run magnitude will be based on Port Moeller.
Catches as part of the Port Moeller test fishery ticked up sharply Thursday. 157 sockeye were caught, which is way up from the 77 fish caught Wednesday. Rayburn says it's not unexpected to see a steady uptick in catches as we get closer to the traditional peak run through the test fishery area.
Every year, the catches at Port Moeller build to a peak and then decline, and that generally happens somewhere between the 22nd of June and the 4th or 5th of July. Usually around the 29th and the 30th of June is the peak at Port Moeller. But we'll expect them to continue increasing with a few ups and downs until it peaks, and then it generally manifests that way inshore about, with a one-week lag.
On Thursday, 117 sockeye were taken from Station 6, 17 sockeye were taken at Station 8. The harvest at Station 4 was 16 sockeye, and there were just 7 fish taken from Station 2. No fish were harvested at Station 10. Rayburn says the catches so far fit the historical pattern of sockeye catches as part of the test fishery early in the season.
If you look at the historical pattern, Station 6 is always, on average, the highest station. And then depending on how far offshore the run is distributed, some years 4 will be greater than 8, other years 8 will be greater. And it remains to be seen how it will turn out this year.
As like the last couple of years, the Port Moeller test fishery will be using a 200-fathom gill net consisting of alternating 50-fathom panels of 4.5-inch mesh and 5 1/8-inch mesh. On Thursday, 127 of the sockeye were taken from the 5 1/8-inch mesh panels, with 30 fish taken from the 4.5-inch mesh panels. Rayburn says it's a little too early in the season to read too much into the catches and the different mesh sizes.
In the next 4 or 5 days, though, the size distribution at Port Moeller is going to be stable as it's going to be for the rest of the season, meaning that you could probably use it to predict the age composition of what the final run is going to be. And we'll wait for 4 or 5 more days of data to do that. Yesterday, you see more fish in the 5 1/8-inch because of the catches at Station 6. And that just could have been one little school of fish pushing through 6 that happened to hit the 5 1/8-inch mesh. So it's not indicative of a pattern just yet.
One of the biggest challenges of running the Port Moeller test fishery is the impact that weather can have on the fishing effort. It's not unusual for the fishery to be halted due to bad weather, and often the crew has to adjust the station's fish due to weather considerations. Rayburn confirms that today is just such a day.
Today, they sent a message saying that they will start at Station 8 because the storm's coming, and they were afraid of missing some more important inshore stations. So they wanted to make sure they got Stations 8, 6 and 4 fish before they got blown off the water, because Station 10 is not typically a station with the greatest catch. They skipped it. So hopefully we'll get 8 through 2 fish today.
The annual Port Moeller test fishery got started on Monday and is currently scheduled to run through July the 10th. One of the products from the test fishery that many fishermen, processors, and other stakeholders use is the index numbers that are intended to represent the sockeye resource moving through the test fishery area, which stretches from the Port Moeller area to the northwest. The traditional cumulative index number through Thursday is 172. That's the highest cumulative index number since 1990 and is well above the average index number of 58 for June 13th. The cumulative index number was 60, which is higher than the replacement index number recorded through this point in the season in 2011 and in 2012. Rayburn says it might be a little early in the season to read too much into those high index numbers.
That said, it's better than a small index. At this point, it can mean that the run is early, that the run is large, or that the fish per index at Port Moeller is lower than average, meaning that you catch more fish at Port Moeller, but it's not going to equate to more fish inshore. So one of those three possibilities, and it's just too soon to tease them apart.
General wisdom is that the Port Moeller test fishery samples sockeye that are between 5 to 8 days out from the inshore districts of Bristol Bay. The vessel used for the test fishery this year is the Pandellus from Homer. It's owned by the state of Alaska. Fish and Game confirms that the first genetic stock composition estimates from the fishery should be released by ADF&G on June the 20th and will cover the fish caught and sampled between June the 10th and the 17th. KDLG News will be providing extensive coverage of the test fishery during our local news and in the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. The updates from the test fishery can be found online on the website of the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association. That website is bbrsda.com. The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report will continue in a moment right here on listener-supported public radio, KDLG. This is KDLG's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. I'm Mike Mason. The over 1,800 Bristol Bay drift net permit holders were invited to Dillingham last Saturday for the annual meeting of the organization that helps market and promote Bristol Bay's world-famous sockeye salmon. The Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association was created back in 2006 when the drifters approved a 1% assessment to fund the work of the RSDA. Each summer, the organization holds an annual meeting, either in Dillingham or Naknek. This year's meeting was held in the gym of the Dillingham Elementary School. In order to make the annual meeting a meeting at which business can be done, there needs to be a quorum of the members equal to about 10%. That's about 185 permit holders. Perhaps as many as 30 permit holders showed up last week, and that resulted in Saturday's meeting being an informational meeting. One of the main missions of the BBRSDA is to fund projects that will help market or improve the fishery, and this year they are funding 12 projects to the tune of over $500,000. Fritz Johnson from Dillingham sits on the organization's board of directors, and he stressed that the RSDA works to make sure that the funded projects mesh with the strategic plan.
The primary focus of the RSDA is to improve the economic well-being of the fishermen members. And produce a sustainable fishery for Bristol Bay and the highest quality salmon products that we can do. The number one strategy for achieving that is to improve quality and value. Since the RSDA's beginning, the focus on chilling and quality handling has been primary, foremost. And we continue to encourage chilling. We monitor advances in chilling and how, over the years, the percentage of fish coming out of the bay are chilled. And that last year, for the first time, that exceeded 50%. More than 50% of the pack was chilled at the point of harvest.
This year, the BBRSDA is funding two projects related to the goal of chilling fish at the point of harvest. Ocean Beauty Seafoods is scheduled to get upwards of $50,000 to run the ice barge Bristol Lady, and Trident Seafoods is also getting upwards of $50,000 to run the ice barge Bristol Maid. Johnson stressed that the level of funding from the RSDA is tied to the amount of ice actually produced and sold from the ice barges.
Those barges have yet to be sustainable. We're hoping they will be, and the more ice that's sold, the more likelihood that they will achieve sustainability, and maybe one day this subsidy won't be necessary. But in as much as promoting chilling is our number one goal, promoting chilling and fish quality in our strategic plan. We continue to feel that this is important work.
The two ice barges are actually owned by the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, and they will be stationed this season, like last season, in the Nooshagak and Naknek-Wejack districts. The second priority included in the BBRSDA strategic plan is to fund research projects, with a third priority of marketing the bay's sockeye. Johnson announced that the Bristol Bay Heritage Land Trust is slated to get $30,000 to conduct studies in the headwaters of the Nooshagak and Kwajak Rivers.
Trying to find out if things like climate change or the impacts of other activities are affecting the life in the water, and the chemistry and the whole ecosystem, to see what's happening in the streams and if that is changes over time, if that changes over time, and what effect that may have on salmon abundance.
The studies of the Nooshagak and Kwajak headwaters are expected to cost upwards of $220,000, and the BBRSDA funding is just $30,000. Another $30,000 is coming from the Southwest Alaska Salmon Habitat Partnership, but the remaining $160,000 has not yet been secured. Another project that will receive RSDA funding is some market analysis that will be conducted by the McDowell Group. Johnson says they will look at the salmon markets and distribution channels.
Where do our fish end up? In what product forms? And to assess geographic markets for salmon and trends that are going to affect the pace and price, pace of sale and the price paid for fish.
The new market analysis is expected to cost around $64,000 this year. The McDowell Group is expected to produce two reports a year that will be presented to the BBRSDA Board of Directors in the late fall and late spring. Several of the projects funded by the RSDA occur every year, but there are some brand new projects on the list, including a project to assess the sockeye resource in Iliamna Lake. The RSDA board approved $95,000 in funding for this year that will go to the University of Washington's Fisheries Research Institute. Johnson noted that the project is expected to run over the next 2 years.
In voting to approve this project, it was pointed out to us that nobody has really looked at Lake Iliamna and the spawning systems there for many, many years, from back as late as the 1960s. So we know that the Kwajak and that watershed has been often the mother lode of Bristol Bay, and to not know what's going on in those systems, we ought not proceed that way. We ought to know the health of those systems and what potential there is there.
The University of Washington's Fisheries Research Institute is also slated to get $56,000 to look at the economic consequences of changing the sockeye escapement goals in Bristol Bay. Johnson observed that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game had wanted to implement the new goals this season.
There was a decision made that that would not take place right away until there had been a more formal study on how changing escapement goals would, affect productivity and economic impacts of raising those escapement goals. So that project is another one on the agenda there.
Instead of implementing the new escapement goals, ADF&G decided to hold off until a special subcommittee has a chance to investigate the impacts of those new goals. In information presented to the membership, the BBRSDA asserts that the project will not include specific escapement goal recommendations. Instead, the project will include an evaluation of a range of consequences of alternate escapement goals that can be used by Fish and Game and the Alaska Board of Fisheries when they take up the issue in future years. The executive director of the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association is Bob Waldrop, who stressed that the Fisheries Research Institute project will be done in conjunction with the work of the special subcommittee created by the Alaska Board of Fisheries.
The Board of Fish appointed a working group. That working group itself has not decided what its work plan is. We're ready to contribute to it, but we're not going to be outside people advising them. We want to help fund something that they are actually need and want and will use.
The final project outlined during last Saturday's BBRSDA annual meeting was the $25,000 that is being given to this radio station to help expand our commercial fisheries coverage during the summer. And that includes producing this program, the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. One of the main focuses of the BBRSDA for the last couple of years has been to lobby for protections for Bristol Bay from the potential negative impacts of large-scale mining projects like the proposed Pebble Mine. Saturday's annual meeting featured an update on those efforts from RSDA board member Catherine Carscallen from Dillingham.
The overall strategy, like you know, is in line with the local Bristol Bay tribes who put in the request to the federal government, to the Environmental Protection Agency 3 years ago now, to take an action on Pebble and give us a proactive decision on the main permit that Pebble would need. So we're still in that effort. We're still on a pretty good path.
What Carscallen was referring to was the effort by several local tribes, Trout Unlimited and other organizations, to get the EPA to use its authority to stop the issuance of dredge and fill permits that the Pebble Limited Partnership would need to start development of the Pebble Mine. The Corps of Engineers are in charge of those permits, which are called 404 permits, thanks to the section of the Clean Water Act that governs the permits. Within that language is language that basically gives the EPA the veto authority for the issuance of permits. Instead of starting a 404C process, as it's called, the EPA instead put together the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. The public comment period on the latest version of the assessment is currently open through the end of the month, and Carscallen confirmed that the RSDA and other proponents of the EPA using its 404C veto authority will be trying to get more fishermen to comment in the coming days.
You'll see down at the harbor, that harbor booth, that van that we've got painted up and decorated is going to be up and running over the next 3 weeks or so, and we'll have comment cards there where people can go down and get comments in, and that's probably the best thing you can spread the word about and let your crew know and let everyone know. If anyone didn't get a chance to comment in the first round, the comment period has been extended, so go down there, fill out a comment card. It's the best, quickest, easy way to get your voice in, and so we're hoping at the end of this comment period they won't extend it again. We'll probably see the watershed assessment wrapped up by this fall, and that's the point where the EPA could make a decision on this permit and could come up with some sort of a proactive protection or decision on Pebble, basically. And so we'll be working on that a lot in the fall and really pushing for a decision, hopefully sometime next year.
What Carscallen didn't mention during her presentation was that the EPA has never used its 404C veto authority in advance of the start of the NEPA permitting process. She also didn't mention that the NEPA process could take many years to finalize. Some observers believe it could take 5 to 7 years to write and complete the environmental impact statement that would be required for a project the size and the scope of the proposed Pebble Mine. If the EPA does step in and preemptively stop the issuance of the 404 permits, it will likely prompt a lengthy court fight that could ultimately delay the process even more. You can find additional details about the BBRSDA's fight to stop development of large mining projects in the Bristol Bay region on the association's website at bbrsda.com. You can read the EPA's Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment on the EPA Region 10 website. This is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. Stay tuned.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is made possible in part by the Alaska Independent Fishermen's Marketing Association, 800-816-3741, or on the web at AIFMA.org.
And you're tuned in to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report, your source for commercial fishing news and information. I'm your host, Mike Mason. Thanks to a $40,000 grant from the BBRSDA, B&C Fiberglass and the PAF Boatyard in Dillingham have developed a mold to put flush decks on Rawson and Wegley 32-foot vessels. B&C just finished installing a flush deck on their first A-model Wegley, the fishing vessel Carol Jean, and they've done three Rawsons so far. The upgrade isn't necessarily cheap, but does qualify for BBEDC's Vessel Improvement Grant Program. KDLG's Dave Binegar has more.
Back in 2008, BBRSDA offered Bill Henderson at B&C Fiberglass a grant to develop a flush deck mold for some of the older boats in the fleet.
BBRSDA funded a grant to build plugs and molds to put a flush deck into Rawson's. They wanted the Rawson owners to know that their boats were capable of being upgraded to meet the new quality standards that they were trying to get. So they funded the project. We built the molds. We made parts, we brought them up, we've installed them, and so far in three Rawsons. This is the first Wegley, the Carol Jean, that we've tried to install them in, and it worked fine. It fits Wegleys and Rawsons nicely.
The flush decks have a number of advantages, including just for the comfort of the crew.
Initially, the flush deck started being put in, at least I was of the opinion this was why, because it was easier on the crew. It didn't require so much work, so they didn't You know, they weren't getting worn out as quickly.
And now, with added emphasis on raising the quality of the delivered product, flush decks have an advantage for simply cutting down on the movement of the fish.
They don't get handled as much, getting them into the fish holds. In our particular mold case, we have nicely rounded, gel-coated, molded corners, so as the fish do slide across the deck, they're not sliding over hard edges and scraping the scales off and that sort of thing. So there's an advantage there to a molded surface versus a one-off custom laminate surface, which is what we've always done until now.
It took BNC about a week and a half to finish installation on the Carol Jean. After the owners had gutted the old deck and holds themselves, the new one comes with 10 fish holds,
which are all smaller in size, and that's what the fish companies are after these days. Still will pack around 9 or 10,000 pounds under the lids, but it's a nice, tidy little fish hold setup.
Henderson says BNC's flush decks can accommodate some RSW upgrades, and the bulkheads beneath the deck are built to add insulation.
We use Canaccord lightweight honeycomb panels, which have a 3 times the R-value of a 3/4 inch sheet of plywood. So you're getting quite a bit of R-value in your fish hold with this installation. The only thing left at that point to insulate would be the hull side and hull bottom in the fish bins. Everything else is already insulated automatically with our system.
So far, BBRSDA seems satisfied with their public-private partnership, which has developed a convenient and cost-effective way for some of the smaller boats in the fleet to make a nice upgrade.
That was our RSDA's goal when they started, was to try to demonstrate to the Rossin and Small Wegley, small boats in general, owners that their boats were upgradable. They didn't have to buy a new boat, and they weren't going to get left behind.
And there's up to $20,000 on the table to make upgrades like this under BBEDC's Vessel Improvement Grant Program. Henderson says the A-model Wegley they just finished refitting cost about $35,000, but he's going to sell kits for the do-it-yourselfers that should come in under $20,000, meaning with a little elbow grease, Wegley and Rawson owners could probably get into a new flush deck for free. For the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report, I'm Dave Benninger.
It's still early in the 2013 Bristol Bay sockeye fishery, but there has been some fishing effort in the east side districts. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game confirms that nearly 85,000 sockeye were harvested in the Igigik district this week. The weekly fishing schedule for the Igigik and Ugashik districts came to an end this morning at 9. From now on, all fishing time in both districts is done via emergency order. The ADF&G area management biologist for the Igigik and Ugashik districts is Paul Solomon. He confirms that he'll be mirroring fishing time in the Ugashik district with what he allows in the Igigik district.
I'm going to start the season off like we did last year. I'll base everything initially on what happens in Igigik, because typically the Ugashik runs a little bit later. And if I open that district up early to any length of time, I run the risk of having a big fleet down there picking off fish that aren't local. So I'm going to go slow with that. I also don't want to have a situation where I have Igigik open one day and Ugashik open the next day and have people bouncing back between the two. You can fish where you want to, but you have to pick one.
Solomon confirms that on June 25th, which is the day that fishermen have to register for a district, he'll separate the management of the two districts. In an update that was issued today, Fish and Game noted that the in-river test fishery in the Igigik district is in the process of deploying and should become operational sometime this weekend. The counting towers on the Igigik River should be up and counting sometime Monday or Tuesday. Normally, it takes sockeye a couple of days to travel between the Igigik district and when they're counted at the towers on the river. However, Solomon asserts that the travel time can vary, especially if the sockeye stack up in the lagoon.
Last year, that's what happened. We had 5 or 6 days of passage into the river, but nothing past the tower. They were stacking up in the lagoon. I think it's temperature related. If the water in the lagoon is within a good comfort range and the water coming out of the lake is colder, they have a tendency to stay in the lagoon. Same thing happens in the ocean. They have a physical comfort zone that they like to be in as far as temperature goes, and if they find something that is to their liking, they'll stay in it rather than leave it.
At the moment, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is holding off on announcing fishing time in both the Igigik and Ugashik districts until some solid escapement information becomes available. In today's announcement, Fish and Game noted that the next opener in the Igigik district is likely to be for set net fishermen only to help gauge the presence and the abundance of Igigik fish. The earliest an opener could occur is Sunday afternoon. Solomon says one of the things he's noticed in recent years is the difference in how and when sockeye start moving through the Igigik district.
Right now, the bathymetry of the bay, Igigik Bay, is changing a little bit. The sandbars are moving around. The south spit's starting to open up. The last couple of years, we've had a lot of fishing activity on the south line. I think that's just where they happen to hit the district first. Many other times we hear the north line was where fish will pass through. Last year that wasn't the case. That could have something to do with how the flow patterns out of the bay are changing through time. I mean, they orient to the river currents and to the smell that they get from home, and that's what kind of drives where they go. Sometimes if the currents are kind of confused, they don't find a good trail to follow, so they wander a little bit. But I think it changes. I don't think there's anything consistent with it. There might be patterns that exist for a couple of years, but I think they definitely change through time.
Often the Igigik District will feature the largest drift net fleet in the bay, especially early in the season. The Ugashik District is different in that the drift fleet is much smaller, but Solomon suggests it's been growing in recent years.
I think one reason for the increased effort is we've got better markets down there. We didn't have those when I first started, plus we had limit issues, which really kind of contracted everything. But now it's kind of stabilized, and there's folks that go down there and fish that didn't before, simply because there's markets down there now that there weren't before, which is a good thing. It kind of spreads the fleet out for the rest of the bay. The guys who are used to only fishing with 12 guys in Ugashik or 13 guys don't like it too much. But realistically, if a big push comes in with that few people down there, I can't stop it. So having around 100 boats makes an impact on passage. It's still fairly comfortable for the fleet that's down there. It's still spread out, but we've had more than that recently, particularly towards the end of the season. So it really hasn't changed the management style that much. Sometimes I need fleet in order to impact big pushes. And as I said before, the run is a little earlier than it used to be.
Fishermen in both the Igigik and Ugashik districts are asked to stand by at noon on Sunday for the next announcement about fishing time. Fishermen should note that starting Monday, the Fishing Game Office in King Salmon will begin their summer hours. Those hours are 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. 7 days a week. The 7-day-a-week schedule will run through July the 17th. The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report will continue in a moment. This is the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report here on KDLG. An effort to train people for jobs in the seafood processing industry will get started this fall in the Bristol Bay region. The Bristol Bay Jobs Accelerator Project is a partnership between the Bristol Bay Native Association and the Southwest Alaska Vocational and Educational Center in King Salmon. Alhide Herman is the Instructional Operations Manager for SAVIC. She confirms that many of the details of the new program have not yet been finalized.
We're kind of, scouting what kind of classes we're going to have. We're going to look at how we can keep fishermen in business. You know, it might be, six-pack licenses or able-bodied seaman license, some of those small things. And there's a program that's called Train the Trainer program with the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association. So in order for the Bristol Bay residents to comply with the Coast Guard regulations, we need more people that can do the drill conductor training. So that might be a portion of it.
Last summer, BBNA received a $405,000 grant from the federal government to fund the Jobs Accelerator Project. The first series of classes through the project is expected to run from September through December. The effort to expand the ability of area residents to participate in the seafood industry is a high priority of the Bristol Bay Native Association, which is a consortium of the 31 Alaska Native tribes from the Bristol Bay region. Patty Hyeno is the director of the Program Development Department. She says the new Jobs Accelerator Project fits well within the Bristol Bay vision that was developed by entities across the Bristol Bay region back in 2011.
One of the big things about the results of that was, development in renewable resources. And so this fits right in with that. People want jobs. This fits with that, so it works very well with the visioning project.
If you're interested in the project or you want additional information, you can contact the Southwest Alaska Vocational Center in King Salmon. That concludes today's edition of the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. The report can be heard each Friday, Saturday, and Sunday during the fishing season. If you have a news tip or information about the commercial fishing season to pass along, you can email it to me, mike@kdlg.org.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, ensuring long-term growth in the world's greatest salmon fishery through investments in Bristol Bay science, infrastructure, marketing, and quality. The Bristol Bay RSDA. We're on board with you.